This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 27th of June 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from London. Coming up...
Mr. Speaker, the British people have voted to leave the European Union. It was not the result I wanted, nor the outcome that I believe is best for the country I love. But there can be no doubt about the result.
The UK's outgoing Prime Minister, David Cameron, rules out a second Brexit referendum. But could that decision be left for his successor? Meanwhile, in the British Parliament...
Our country is divided. And the country will thank neither the benches in front of me nor those behind for indulging in internal factioning manoeuvring at this time.
The leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, lashes disunity in his own party as the divisive aftermath of last week's events continues to tear at the threads of the United Kingdom. That's today on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dzhevsky, a columnist for The Independent, and Robert Fox, defence editor of the London Evening Standard. Welcome both to the programme. As the shockwaves of last week's vote to leave the European Union subsided, well, almost, a wave of possibilities began to emerge, from Scotland spoiling Boris Johnson's dream to more negotiations followed by a second referendum. Just about everyone has had a theory on what could happen. However, David Cameron is still the Prime Minister and he's holding firm to the result of the referendum. But with no one yet stepping up to lead the nation out of the EU, will the ultimate outcome be determined by whoever fills the Westminster power vacuum? Mary, just looking at the... Chaotic day in Britain yet again. We've watched the falling apart over the last 2 days of the Labour Party. Most members of the Shadow Cabinet have now resigned. Jeremy Corbyn seems indifferent to it. We think that maybe as many as 70% of the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, will vote against him. Still won't budge. He was in, Even the mildest political commentator would say he was beyond inept in this vote for the referendum. First of all, let's deal with them. Is there any hope that they can sort themselves out?
Well, I think it's very difficult to see how they can sort themselves out in the next sort of week. But I actually have a lot more sympathy for Jeremy Corbyn than most of his parliamentary colleagues seem to have, because the way that the Labour Party leadership works is that you are elected from members and people who paid a fee this time around from around the country. He has a democratic mandate. And the trouble is, because of the sort of mismatch of timings and the fact that the MPs largely come from different sort of Blairite wing of the Labour Party, then you've got this enormous conflict between, as it were, a new old style Labour Party that Corbyn represents and the sort of middle Blair period that the majority of his MPs represent. And it's very hard to bring those into line. But I have to say that my sympathies are actually with Corbyn on this. He has the mandate.
Well, he may have the mandate, Mary, but he's damn useless. You know, and that's the problem for the PLP, is that they have to work up close with him. They see he can't lead, he can't inspire, he can't tell a truthful story when he goes down the campaign trail. We have this story that one of his MPs, Chris Bryant, asked him how he voted, and he wouldn't even confirm they'd actually voted for us to remain in.
Well, of course, the perverse thing about all this is that if Corbyn had stuck to what everybody assumes were his original principles, that he was actually a left-wing Brexiteer, then he'd actually have been on the winning side. And everything would have been consistent and everything would have been sort of lined up. And I have to say, I mean, Corbyn gave a decent speech in the House this afternoon. It was a perfectly good speech in response to Cameron's announcement of what was going to happen next, which was itself pretty chaotic.
Well, Robert, what do you make? Yeah, kind of a good speech, but this is the whole problem. Yeah, he can speak to his constituency. He can speak to the people who like his, you know, his politics. And you know, Mary kind of, you know, cast aspersions on the Blairites. I heard something yesterday. You know, someone said, you know, the problem is we've got too many centrist politicians. What's wrong with a centrist politician? What's wrong with someone who straddles the middle ground? You know, we've pushed politics, you know, this has been the most ugly, ugly referendum. It's pushed people to the far right and to the far left. We've seen the consequences of that today with race tax all across the country. Surely we want some kind of, you know, Blair, I know the word is tarnished, but we want some centrist politicians who can appeal to real voters.
What a very long question. Is that a question?
Well, it is a question. I just dismay at the political
Can I just take Mary out? The trouble is, with Corbyn, he's supposed to be the leader of Her Majesty's opposition. He's supposed to be leading an effective opposition in Parliament. In the world, in space, whatever time continuum you look like, I cannot see Jeremy Corbyn in his present incarnation. He would have to be reborn to lead an effective parliamentary opposition. You are right, though. Because that's not really his game. He is a figure of protest. And in a way, he is with the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, the kind of strange populism. I'm not going to be impolite about it, but it was a strange populism that took so many people, including myself, by surprise and then pushed with a wider margin than was expected. It was 4%, the Leave vote. On what criteria, it's not clear yet. And I think the analysis is going to be very, very important. There are things we need to be told about our nation. But he is out of doors. He does not believe in Parliament. He thinks his mandate comes from the street, the hedgerows or whatever. He's in a very strong English tradition. He is in the tradition of John Wilkes, of Bradlaugh, of people who looked for, and some of the Irish, great Irish politicians, who did not trust Parliament. But at the moment, I won't say that it's toxic. I think it's even worse. It is really dangerous to have somebody who should be an alternative who really doesn't believe in the system.
I mean, I have some sympathy with that. But I also think there's a danger in this sort of lauding of the political centre. I was at a briefing this morning and there was a sort of a blithe assumption that everything would sort of slip back together again and that there you would have a Labour Party sort of united around the centre of a Labour position, and you would have centre-right, a sort of, you know, post-Cameron, and it would all be fine. But actually, when you look back, one of the problems with British politics has been the very centrist nature of both leading parties, that there hasn't been a proper opposition. So what we had during the referendum campaign was all sorts of things come out of the woodwork, including the immigration debate, the sovereignty debate, which we hadn't had.
Yes, but it's a good centrist politics would be able to deal with those issues. And the problem is, you know, that we've, you know, this lauding in the opposite way of the fringes means that we have 4 million people to vote for Nigel Farage. That, you know, that doesn't seem to me to be a success story, that you march the Labour Party so far to the left that, you know, 30% of people who said they'd voted for Miliband last time said they will not now vote for the Labour Party whatsoever. They've moved to the far right. That is not a success. Centrist politics could have held those people in place.
But it's not a success either for whatever proportion of the British population that voted for UKIP in the last general election, that the result of that was one MP in Parliament.
Well, let's look at David Cameron. David Cameron, you know, he spoke in the House today, oddly seemed, I think, rather freed of all kind of burden, rather amusing, and did his usual best. But, you know, he's said today a few things. It's his belief that we should be part of, you know, the European economic area. He's said he doesn't think there would be a second referendum. It's not really for him to decide. And let's be honest, I think the second referendum is a kind of a hope of the people who feel that they have lost more than a vote over the past few days. But what do we think will unfold over the, we now know that they're going to try and rush in a new prime minister by September. Either of you, where do you feel, Robert, we'll start with you, where do you feel that the narrative will go over the next coming days? Do you feel that it is going to, coming weeks, are we going to be looking at Boris in power, Boris pressing the red button and setting the whole bomb off already by October?
I want to take you up on something. You've been much too kind to Cameron. Cameron's a disaster. It's very interesting. I'm very fond of history, and it isn't just Trivial Pursuit, but there's been more than a few commentators who are very good, by the way, and they are from the middle ground, but they're talking reason. And there's a lot of non-reason coming from the fringes on either side for the uber pro-Europhiles and from the Leavers. Cameron has probably been, he's up there, you know, with Anthony Eden and Lord North for being possibly one of the most disastrous incumbents of Number 10 Downing Street. He's a serial miscalculator. He's frivolous. He's highly intelligent. I have very close mutual friends, he can be quite very agreeable. And this is not an attack on his private persona, but on his public persona, yes. His behaviour has been all but incredible. From the moment he came in and said it's going to be austerity all the way, not practically like Marie Antoinette. This is what's happened in the Northeast and the Northwest. Let them eat cake. He has done nothing for his party. He has done nothing for his succession. He destroyed willfully the allies that possibly could have got him out of the current problem, namely the Liberal Democrats, and that was his main brilliant and cruel and crude tactic. We don't go for coalition politics. I'm going to rule on my own, and he's barely lasted. He hasn't lasted 18 months in doing that. And he's left. One of the principal, because when all is said and done, when you look back over the past 200 years, on the whole, the parliamentary system has worked on alternanzas, the Italians call it, the alternative of two main party blocs. Both of them are in ruins now, as we speak tonight. And in no small measure is that entirely due to the arrogant assumptions and miscalculations of David Cameron and his clique, because he is one of these strange people. It's been brought up over and over again, and it is true, he seems to go around in a bubble.
I agree, Robert, but he's gone.
And he's gone.
So we now have to deal with the successor.
You were being kind to him. He has not prepared his succession.
Can I
just finish answering your question? The point is that the likely successors, who are Theresa May, the Home Secretary, and Boris Johnson, I don't think they would last 18 months. And I don't think they could deliver in either of them a new arrangement with Europe and possibly the outside world. And that's the trouble that we're in. There will have to be a general election at some point in the next 6 to 18 months. And then I think all will be to play. And I think probably the two major party alternation system, I think, will be shattered in that time, because I can see nothing that the Conservative parliamentary leadership, because they've had this strange undertow of Brexiteers, Little England on their side, and the people that, I mean, it's a house really truly divided against itself, the Labour parliamentary party, even, that I think you will get individuals, independents, you will get single issue candidates, and it's going to be very difficult to put it together again.
Well, I'd like to come back with like 24 points of that. But anyway, we'll move on. Mary?
I sort of think that, I mean, you know, if we look at the succession, and I would be slightly kinder to Cameron than Robert has been, I think that Boris has disaster spelt all over him, that you could see that when he effectively won the referendum, he looked as though he had not the first idea, that he had totally not calculated with winning. In other words, whatever the motivation for, as it were, heading the campaign to leave Europe, whether it was personal or whether it was principled, the calculation was that it wouldn't actually happen. So I think that it's hard to see that if Boris became Prime Minister, unless he sort of grows up and rethinks very, very fast, that he could last much longer than Robert's 18 months. I also think that Theresa May, even if she were elected, which is hardly a foregone conclusion, that she probably too would be seen very much as an interim sort of compromise candidate. And I actually would go further than Robert and say that I think there's going to be an election before Christmas, because I think whoever becomes the next Conservative leader, whether they decide to be opportunistic and capitalise on the grief of the Labour Party, or whether in fact it's slightly more idealistic and they learn from the dreadful experience of Gordon Brown, who wimped out of having an election, as it were, to consecrate, to give him a democratic mandate. And that was a burden that he carried right through his brief prime ministership, and one reason why he lost the next election.
Robert, you get the impression, yeah, I think Mary is right. You saw their faces when they won. They were not prepared. We've seen them today saying, we will begin discussing what we might like to happen. Yeah, this is the disgraceful thing saying, we, even if they put in a prime minister in September, we're left with 2 months with markets, businesses, companies, private individuals, not having a damn clue where we're going, where they want to drag us. And you do get the impression that they just kind of, you know, it was an amusing debate society, and they've kind of come out on the other side. So, you know, Boris doesn't make it, you know, maybe Theresa May doesn't make it, but this question of, you know, will they invoke Article 50, do you think that is going to happen?
I think it will happen. So you made some very interesting points all the way through, both of which I entirely agree with. They had no plan. They had no vision of Britain in the world, either in Europe or semi-detached from Europe or completely independent from Europe. This was absolutely striking throughout the referendum debate. And when challenged, Farage, ever the populist, said, "You're not electing me to government." You know, he was there to stir up, and he's the agitator, and he's in a great European tradition. I must say, I'm going to take you up. I think there's one other alternative, and it's shades of the very early 1930s. I think things may be so bad, the way things are going, particularly if the markets go the way they are. And by the way, your favourite wonderful phrase, pressing the red button and invoking Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, I think they're terribly scared of doing it. I think all of the above that we have named are absolutely terrified, because then the clock starts ticking and you're out within two, bit of elasticity, 3 years at the most. I think we may go to a grand coalition at some point, and I think that may be the result of the general election. I absolutely agree with Mary that I think that they can't, none of them has a mandate. Andrew, all the people you've named really don't have a mandate to do this. Neither Theresa May nor Boris nor somebody who may come up in the middle.
I think it was so striking. I mean, we had this really long referendum campaign. I mean, Britain isn't used to long campaigns, because our general elections are usually, campaigns are 3 weeks a month. And this was a really long campaign with the unofficial bit and the official bit. And then at the end of it, you know, somebody wins, and then all three of them who were sort of leading the campaign came out and said, "Oh, I don't think we want to do anything quite, we don't want to do anything rash, we don't want to do anything now, we need to take our time." And I mean, if I'd been voting on the other side, I would have said, "Well, what did you think?"
They resiled. Mary is absolutely right on the three cardinal points about immediate withdrawal, immigration, more money out of Europe and into the National Health Service. The principles, as Mary said, all went back on it within 24 hours. Where are we?
So the liberal urban elite that's been kind of slapped around in this as kind of the enemy.
But speak up for them.
I was just going to say, it is us, but you know, I heard on Saturday a debate in which a member of Nigel Farage's party, UKIP, he was talking to Emily Thornberry, and he picked her up and said, you know, she said that, you know, she was nervous because it meant that for her, you know, while she'd been able to go to university and think about studying abroad, for her kids, that looked like it would be blocked. And he said, you know, there you go with your middle class values. Nobody cares about your kids going to university. So, you know, let's just recap. This is a moment where I really powerfully disagree with you, because this is centrist. Centrist is the desire to get a good education for your kids, the desire to be, you know, to accept diversity, the desire to be a little bit charitable to people around you. Yet, you know, you look at London, all those things work incredibly well. And I've had conversations just over this weekend, you know, a neighbour, she's Swiss, he's Norwegian, you know, they have a really interesting company. They're thinking it's not really feasible for them to wait 3 years to find out what happens here. They're already looking at moving that company. And that's hundreds and hundreds of decisions. Tiny thing, went to get my haircut. The guy who's going to have an extension build to his house, he said, "I've cancelled it. I'm nervous." That's a builder that doesn't have a job. Those are just like people you bump into, ordinary people. You know, we are going to be dragged down by this. It's time to listen to the urban elite.
But yes, the problem is that what you have injected into the debate, Andrew, quite rightly, is this element, which I'm going to use the ancient French term because it's a polite version of something we could call cruder in English. It's a jacquerie, a spontaneous explosion, which you've got all over medieval Europe and continued. It happens in China, and it happened in 1358 when the harvest failed, the French army was defeated, and the whole countryside exploded into an almost leaderless and programmeless revolt. You're quite right. It's not the middling and the lesser sort of person, John Wilkes's phrase, that Farage is appealing to. This is ordinary people, implying that people like Mary and myself, you know, degree educated, commentariat, multilingual, we're not ordinary people, and therefore we should be excluded. What is so interesting is the element of scarcely concealed rage in this protest vote that we got. And it's very similar to some of Trump's supports. Now, this is very, very worrying because actually in the middle ground, let's step back from politics and I'm going to stand up for the commentariat. Look at some of the quality of comment in the British print media. Sorry, I'm somebody who spent half his life doing what you're doing. I was in the BBC for over 20 years. But the print media has absolutely nothing to be ashamed in the commentariat, apart from the crudity of the Daily Mail, of the tabloids and the near tabloids like the Daily Telegraph, which should be mentioned in the Hall of Shame because they really did distort facts and the truth. But the discussion at the level that I'm describing, somebody like Matthew Paris in the Times last Saturday, it really is deep, profound tautology, but it's really the kind of things we really need to be thinking and talking and deciding on to get out of this. And the idea, you're quite right, it is a centre-periphery thing, and this is the argument which Farage has played on, but it just don't work. Actually, yes, London is rich and has been successful, but it's made a hell of a lot of money for this country.
And it's been the case since 1500s to get over
Exactly.
Mary, just on this issue, you know, it's really intriguing, you know, this kind of, you know, Govian, you know, we don't need experts view. Now, you know, those experts include people who run businesses. So they went to the CBI, they went to big companies. Yeah, of course they could find, you know, a Mr. Dyson or somebody from, you know, JCB who would kind of stick up for them. But on the whole, people said, you know, it will affect my investment patterns. It will impact on what I'm doing. And they ignored that. They deliberately ignored that. They said, don't take, you know, business is bad. Ignore big business. And now we're going to pay the consequences. Lots and lots of people are going to lose their jobs over the coming months.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree with what you say. But I also look from as it were, the other perspective. And you say, well, there were the 200 economists that warned Margaret Thatcher of what would happen. They were wrong. There was a complete parliamentary consensus on the Iraq war. Nobody except the small Liberal Democrats were arguing against it as a party. There was consensus on light touch regulation that brought us the banking crisis. That was, as it were, an elite consensus of centrists in Parliament. And those things went catastrophically wrong. And not just for all those people out there in the country, but for us as well.
OK, we ignore it. But do you look at the landscape ahead over the next, you know, 2 months, 6 months, a year and think, oh, actually, this is going to work out OK?
Well, I was just trying to think today and thinking, well, maybe, you know, if you really, really look on the bright side, you can say, well, the UK has a long tradition of constitutionality and stability and, you know, what you say when you're talking about other countries, the rule of law. Even if Scotland breaks away, I wouldn't
Which
be
I don't think
averse
it will, by the way.
I wouldn't be averse to a united Ireland. I mean, you can see some sort of benefits from that. And maybe the remaining England and Wales could feel sort of comfortable in its skin as a relatively small country, relatively insignificant on the edge of Europe. Maybe that's how it was always meant to be.
Well, that doesn't sound like a triumph to me. But, you know, but Robert, if we look at Boris, you know, he's effectively then going to be in 18 months, you know, he can make a united Ireland, get rid of Scotland, you know, he can, you know, destroy the economy. He this isn't a kind of legacy of success he's going to be attaching to.
He fulfilled the Cameron legacy, though.
Well, you know, how can he look at the narrative that lies ahead and feel confident about it?
Well, to come back to the point, I mean, Boris's rhetoric worries me. You know, this is going to be Independence Day. I mean, the trouble is he is a bit like Henry VIII. He believes what he actually particularly thinks or wants to say at the moment. And that is very worrying. And what you are, where you are absolutely right is the I agree with you. The repositioning of Britain. Yes, overinflated view of the country, but they do have the culture and the language, which gives a peculiar position, particularly in the globalised community, the globalised economy. But there will be a readjustment. But equally, and I don't think we've got over much time to discuss this, there will absolutely have to be a readjustment within Europe and core EU Europe in a way that we're not hearing too much from the principal players. It's actually the people who are somewhat peripheral, also somewhat semi-detached, like the Danes and the Swedes, that are really saying that, and they're the ones who regret the UK's departure the most. But the idea of greater convergence, the fact that Merkel is talking with Renzi and with Hollande today, there is no possible chance. And I think Merkel herself is shrewd enough to see, do you really want to be convergent between the Berlin economy, the Paris economy, and the Rome economy, which is a work of fiction anyway? I think that it's a high tide mark for Europe. And from the comment I get from my Dutch relations, my Italian friends, they sense this too.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there will be a halt to all sorts of things because they realise they don't want this happening elsewhere. But I oddly think that could be the saving of the union. And I think that I think people kind of want it to work. Mary, with this discussion going on, Merkel today said, interestingly this morning, she said, while Juncker is saying it needs to be rushed, you need to start tomorrow, obviously irked by what's happened. But she said, let's be calm, there's no kind of rush. Now, it's another kind of fantasy theory for the people who were Remainers. But do you think that she thinks that actually give it a couple of months, have a round of negotiations, and certainly not remain within the EU, but a stronger form of associate membership might be possible than a pure leave?
Well, I think she might be. She might like that idea, but there will be plenty of people who will say, well, the problem is that if you're too kind to the Brits, then that's a recipe for everybody else to grab what they can and a recipe for disintegration. So I think you've got to be very careful with that. She was obviously very wise, very prudent to talk about, maybe adjusting a bit more to what looks like the British timescale rather than this rush that the Europeans want. I'm actually on the side of the Europeans here. I think, if the Brits are going to do it, they should do it. And I don't understand why Cameron has left invoking Article 60 to his successor. I mean, the referendum was clear. Everybody's accepted the results. You don't have all of us occupying Parliament Square and saying this was an unfair referendum. It's been accepted.
I think you will see that over the coming days. I think people.
It's funny. All the discussions that I've had with Mary on Midori House, this is where they're not they're quite interesting, our points of difference, because I'm going to go sort of geopolitical. And then when you look at what's really going on in the world, in the dynamics of human population, of which this is a very significant tipping point, the row about migration and the movement of people, by the way, you can't stop that. This is absolute nonsense. It's such a false prospectus that this was offered in the referendum debate. But the point is that I don't think, and I think Merkel is big enough to realise this, no man is an island. You cannot cut off the UK from Europe because Europe is such a diminishing part of global commerce and of global human commerce. And you've cut out, sorry to do parolacce, a bloody great part of the European market. And I think there's going to be quite a lot of that. There's a lot of sort of thumb-sucking, say, it's actually, we've invoked Shakespeare and all this sort of, it's actually Stan Laurel we should be invoking. Mess you've got us into, Ollie.
As a coda, because both of us have covered these sort of things in different ways and from different angles.
I guess for a century between us.
The degree to which everything suddenly seems to have been in flux since 4:30 in the morning last Friday probably the only degree of uncertainty that is parallel with that is when the Eastern Central European borders started collapsing at the end of the Cold War, and the moment when sort of the fate of the Soviet Union was in the balance. Those 3 years, that is the only comparable thing, probably in our lifetime, to the uncertainty that we're looking at now.
I was born in 1945 and remember there was a colossal pressure of population in that time. I know Europe was destroyed, but huge movements of people. And I fear that this is the thing that's really going to hit Europe, is this growing movement from outside. It's the south to north. I'm talking about it metaphorically in geopolitical jargon terms, not geographically. But I think this is the beginning of, you know, another development in the long durée, the long play out. And unfortunately, you know, it's like Mickey Mouse in the storm. He wants to abandon the steering wheel.
Well, we're not exactly leaving you on a cheerful note, but hopefully something will come out over the coming days that will give us some heart. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Mary Jaszewski and Robert Fox. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and also by Mari Giusti. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Mr. Robert Pound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.